there are a bunch of different pollution technologies out there in the cruise ships, and some are doing a great job of treating their pollution, and several are not doing a great job at all.
A judge tells state regulators to work on more options for cruise ship wastewater treatment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, despite the national media frenzy, some Alaskans are lukewarm about the release of Sarah Palin's emails.
Well, I'm glad they're being released, but I don't know anything about them. I haven't read them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
A Juneau judge says state regulators need to take another look at cruise ship wastewater treatment systems. Superior Court Judge Patricia Collins ruled the Department of Environmental Conservation failed to consider stronger options for some ships. Earth Justice Attorney Sean Isley says the ruling could lead to cleaner water along cruise ship routes.
There are a bunch of different pollution technologies out there in the cruise ships, and some are doing a great job of treating their pollution, and several are not doing a great job at all. And so we'd hope that DEC would review its permits and basically follow the intent of the statute, which is to force all the cruise ships to use the best technology that's feasible.
The campaign to safeguard America's waters and Friends of the Earth challenged the wastewater permit system through an administrative appeal that failed, and they took it to state court. The ruling, issued this week, poses a series of questions that the state must answer. It also reverses DEC's rejection of the group's administrative appeal. State Attorney Ruth Hamilton Hess says officials are reviewing the judge's decision.
We think it's a more limited ruling in suggesting that we should look at these issues that she has determined based on their Superior Court litigation are the issues that they intended to raise previously before the agency and allow the agency to address those particular issues. So we don't necessarily agree that she has said that we have acted in error here.
She says the state has 30 days to decide whether to appeal the decision to Alaska's Supreme Court. It would not start considering issues raised by the environmental groups until that decision is made. The industry has said cruise lines are doing the best they can and discharge far less pollution than municipalities. Meanwhile, a state science panel is studying technologies that could improve treatment. Emails released today by the state of Alaska show that as Alaskan governor, Sarah Palin struggled with the gossip about her family and marriage. As the newly minted Republican vice presidential nominee, she was dismayed by the sudden onslaught of questions from reporters. She also dealt with death threats from as far away as Belgium. The glimpse into Palin came in more than 24,000 pages of emails released today from her first 21 months as governor. They showed Palin involved closely in the day-to-day business of the state while trying to cope with the increasing pressures that came with her rise from small-town mayor to governor to national prominence. The national media descended on Juneau earlier this week in anticipation of the release, which comes nearly 3 years after the initial public records request. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Reporters, cameramen, and bloggers from nearly every major national news organization crammed into the third-floor hallway of the Court Plaza building, known in Juneau as the Spam Can. About a dozen dollies lined the hall, piled 5 feet high with boxes of documents. When the time came, Governor Sean Parnell's spokeswoman, Sharon Lehow, released them to the media.
They're all yours. Let her rip.
We're leaving.
All right.
Thanks. Each set of boxes contained more than 24,000 pages of Palin's emails. Lehow, who also worked for Palin, says the documents were culled from the state accounts of 55 current and former Alaska officials whom Palin emailed using her private Yahoo account.
Employees who had frequent communication with the governor, for instance, the lieutenant governor, the chief of staff, deputy chief of staff, her press people, special assistants.
The state is charging $725 for a complete copy of the records to cover the cost of printing. Governor Parnell's office will only make one public review copy available throughout the entire state. That frustrates Republican activist and Palin critic Andre McLeod, who says the state should have made the records available electronically.
It would have lowered the barriers of the access for information, which technology does. It democratizes information. But the Parnell administration has not caught up with that yet, and I don't believe they're interested in doing so.
Some state lawmakers have ordered copies that will be available to the public in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kenai. And many of the news organizations that paid for the documents have already posted them online. MSNBC.com, working with a team of Juneau volunteers, has hired electronics investigation company Crivella West to sort through the records. Co-founder and CEO Arthur Crivella says within minutes of them being posted on the web, they're sent to computers at the company's headquarters in Pittsburgh. The computers then study the emails for language that may be interesting to Crivella's trained researchers.
Essentially, we're looking for personal language. We're looking for emotional language, you know, where she's anybody in their administration is emotional about something, alarmed, the language of deception.
MSNBC.com investigative reporter Bill Dedman admits the document dump could be a complete waste of time, but he says someone has to vet Palin with her profile as a national political figure.
Some of what we get, I think, out of a public records like this is not some blockbuster scandal. I don't think it's about that at all. I do think that you get some sense of tone, of character.
The documents were first requested in 2008 by news organizations following Palin's vice presidential bid. Palin resigned in July 2009 after 966 days in office. It took 997 days to fulfill the records request. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
While the mainstream media is whipping itself into a frenzy regarding the release of Sarah Palin's emails, ask any dozen Alaskans at random what they think about it and get a very different reaction. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer hit the street this afternoon to hear what Alaskans think about the long-awaited email revelations.
Say that again.
Do you care one way or another about Sarah Palin's emails, which are being released today?
Regarding what action?
Well, we don't know since there's 23,000 pages of them or something.
Yeah, she can be the president, keep American money in America.
Not even aware of it. So why did the media want them? I don't think it's any of their business.
Regarding Sarah Palin's emails, do either of you know or care or would care to comment?
I never heard about them, so.
Never heard of it.
Thank you. Do you think there's anything in her emails that would hurt her chances?
I haven't read any of them.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
I don't know about them.
All right.
But what is it even about?
The whole Palin thing? I think people look for new and interesting ways to get excited about it. So let's dig into emails. Why not?
Well, I'm glad they're being released, but I don't know anything about them. I haven't read them, and I don't know what they would say.
Do you think there's something in them that could really hurt her or help her in her presumed presidential bid?
They've deleted a lot of them, and she stated that there's nothing in there that's going to be shocking and surprising. So I don't think it's going to be much.
I think it's a waste of money. But
still to come on Alaska News Nightly, pioneer Alaskan Rose Miller celebrates her birthday.
Every penny we help her make, she gives it away to the community anyway. And that's just the way it's going to be until Rosie's no more.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation, and by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Cooler weather has allowed crews battling the Hastings wildfire north of Fairbanks to make headway. Progress is reported on line construction on the more than 24,000-acre fire. Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins told the Borough Assembly last night that local government is cooperating to protect populated areas of Goldstream Valley on the fire's southern perimeter.
The borough has recently issued a license
to forestry to cut fire breaks on borough property just north of the Chattanooga because the fire is beginning to show a southern movement, behavior to burn back towards the Chattanooga River.
Assemblymember Diane Hutchison expressed concern about sentiment she's heard from some people that firefighters are not putting full effort into stopping the Hastings fire that's burned for nearly 2 weeks.
I've heard some negative comments from the public that I just find astounding, that some of them think that that the fire was allowed to burn so that people would have jobs. And those type of comments, they're counterproductive, and they don't recognize the integrity that the firefighters have that are working out there, putting their lives on the line.
More than 800 firefighters are battling the Hastings fire, and a Type 1 team is managing the response, the state's highest priority wildfire. In 2008, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council closed the Northern Bering Sea to bottom trawling. It was open to all kinds of bottom trawling. Until then, it just hadn't occurred. In December, the council was supposed to receive a draft research plan in what is called the Northern Bering Sea Research Area. That will not happen. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
Today, the council received an outline and presentations of previous work to develop the research plan, and the council decided they don't yet want one. The research plan was supposed to focus solely on what would happen to the benthic community, or the species that live on and in the seafloor, if a trawl fishery took place. Some of the public testimony that occurred Thursday showed the council there are concerns regarding more than just bottom species. For example, coastal residents that live around the research area depend heavily on marine mammals and wanted to know the effects trawling would have on whales, walrus, ugruk, and other species of seals. So before seeing a draft research plan, fisheries analyst Nicole Kimball says the council wants more information.
The council took a step back and asked instead to see a white paper that would provide and a compilation of all the background information on the Northern Bering Sea ecosystem, include previous and ongoing relevant research in the Northern Bering Sea, including chronic or acute effects of bottom trawl studies that have been done in other areas, since obviously we haven't done any of that in the Northern Bering Sea.
The council also would like to see a description of the areas in the Northern Bering Sea that might be attractive to commercial bottom trawling with the possible northward movement of flatfish species, like yellowfin sole.
The species that we see potentially moving northward and might potentially be good commercial fisheries, even though at the time there's not an indication that anyone really does want to fish in there. It's all being proactive in that nature.
The information could help further their discussion and deliberations on what kind of research plan would be necessary in the future. One of those who gave testimony yesterday was Julie Raymond Jacobian, a social scientist for the regional nonprofit Kuwerik. In her testimony, she requested that the council do proper consultation with tribes, and she said she was partly pleased and partly disappointed in today's decision. She was hoping they'd stop and reevaluate the whole process.
But at the same time, their decision today to ask council staff and NIMS staff to go back and put together a really thorough background paper on all the existing information is a good step. It should have been done a long time ago. And I think what this does right now is gives the agency more time to get up to date with what they should have been doing all along, which is talking with tribes on a formal government-to-government basis.
Tribes have expressed their desire to have no commercial bottom trawl fishing in the Northern Bering Sea. The council received staff reports on the chum salmon bycatch issue today. Public testimony will continue tomorrow. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kanin.
The first catch report from the Kodiak commercial salmon fishery is in, with a first day total of more than 32,000 fish harvested. The bulk of the catch is sockeye salmon, accounting for 29,530 of the total. Nearly 3,000 are chum salmon. There were 129 kings and 11 early and eager pinks rounding out the catch.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Environmental Protection Agency will not hold up an Army Corps of Engineers permit for an Alaska Railroad bridge across the Tanana River. The EPA had objected to the proposed bridge's location at Salcha due to fish passage and other concerns, but according to a statement from Northwest Regional Administrator Dennis McLaren, the agency will not seek a national-level review of the Army Corps' permit. The $180-plus million bridge will be the longest in Alaska, but initially only provide the military access to training grounds on the other side of the Tanana River. Alaska Railroad President Christopher Odneson says the bridge is the first phase of a long-term plan to extend the Alaska Railroad south.
It is the important piece, though, of the railroad extending to Delta Junction and further on. Without it, then there's no railroad ever going down that direction. So it's the first piece of that. It's actually phase one of a phase four project to build a Delta Junction.
Odneson says the railroad's extension could leverage development of mineral resources along a planned route that would eventually reach all the way to Canada. More than $100 million of the bridge funding is coming from military grants that were endangered if construction did not start this summer. The rest of the money is coming from the state.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. Today, we're launching this new show within a show. But really, we should say we're reviving it. Many of you may remember the hour-long AK that went off the air in 2008. Regrettably, we can't bring back the entire show. But each Friday, Alaska News Nightly will include a shorter version of the award-winning program. It's a chance to look at the quirkiness of Alaskan life, finding the unique stories that don't make their way into the traditional news lineup. And there is no better place to start than in the southeast town of Pelican, where a woman named Rose has spent the last 38 years serving drinks and sometimes dinner to anyone who finds her bar along the city's short boardwalk. She has become one of the town's major tourist attractions, and she's made friends far and wide, something that becomes apparent every time she has a birthday. KCAW's Ed Ronco has the story.
Pelican, Alaska, early afternoon, May 6th. A blue tour boat is entering the harbor, and there on the floating dock to greet it stands Rose Miller, 78 years old. As the boat approaches, a couple people step onto the deck and moon her. Rose turns around, grabs the waistband of her trousers, and quickly returns the welcome. No one has ever accused Rose Miller of being shy.
Welcome to Pelican. Just take your pants off and have a party.
It's Rose's birthday, and the boat is loaded with about 40 people from Juneau, some of whom, let's be honest, are also a bit loaded themselves. They're here to help her celebrate. Now, 40 people is roughly half the population of Pelican, which has lost residents and money since the town's major employer, a cold storage and fish processing facility, shut down in 2008. But on this particular weekend, the boardwalk is busy with partiers. One of them is Pat Peterson. He was a fisherman in his youth, first met Rose after his boat put into a nearby cove to work on gear. When the crew finished early, they asked the skipper for some time off.
He said, all right, we'll go down to Pelican. We came in here, I was 19, drinking age was 19 then. And Rose hadn't had to bar more than a year or two. And she put her arm around me and said, come here, little boy. Had my first shot at tequila, and I've been drinking tequila ever since with her.
Yeah, how many of her birthdays have you come to?
10 or 15 or something like that.
Yeah, very cool.
I've been here for lots of them. I'll be here every year till one of us goes. And I wouldn't say it's going to be her.
Peterson says on Rose's 69th birthday, he bought her 69 roses. And he says the bouquet was so big that he had to charter a plane to get it and himself to Pelican. But he says she's worth it.
She's just the most genuine person you'll ever meet.
If you ask, I mean,
she's
some people,
totally real and sincere. Lady used to run her own tugboat. I mean, back in the 60s, they just didn't do that.
Rose was on that tugboat when she put into Pelican for the first time during some bad weather. The way most people tell it, she came into town, fell in love with the place, and stayed. But it's a little more complicated than that. She did a stint managing a hotel in Hawaii for a year before she bought the bar, and then sold the bar in 96 before buying it back 4 years later.
There's not a lot of pioneers left around, and she is clearly, most definitely one of them.
Mary Miller is Rose's youngest daughter. She tells a story about how a woman named Marguerite Franklin hired Rose to bartend about 45 years ago. At the time, the bartenders' union in Juneau didn't allow women to bartend, and they went on strike in protest of Rose's hiring.
And Marguerite Franklin's bar made a lot of money that week because she kept my mother behind the bar. This is the woman who gave her the loan to buy this bar because she did so well over there.
The bartenders union went on strike because...
Against women bartending.
Say that again?
Against women bartending. These are all male bartenders. Yes.
Rose, the unyielding bartender, quickly became Rose the businesswoman, and in 2008, her establishment was named the Small Business of the Year by the State Chamber of Commerce. One of the criteria for that is consistent community involvement. And while Rose is still behind the bar until closing every night, she's also working in the community, says her daughter.
Every penny we help her make, she gives it away to the community anyway. And that's just the way it's going to be until Rosie's no more.
If you're going to be rich, you're going to be rich all by yourself.
Rose Miller.
When you give back to the people who spend their money here, you know, that's what makes me feel good. I feel like family. Everybody, this whole town's like one family.
So she has fundraisers for local organizations. She's been known to throw a big dinner for fishermen who've had a bad year. And on occasion, when someone comes into town on hard times, Rose will let them do some odd jobs around her establishment, and then give them enough money to move along. Rose acknowledges that 38 years is a long time to bartend, to cook, to sweep, and on and on and on. But her patrons, she says, are her friends, and this town, her life.
Many years ago, everybody was leaving, and they put a sign up down at the plane float that said, "Last one leaving, shut off the lights." You know, I made bumper sticks and stickers and put them all over Alaska, and it said, "Pelican, Alaska's not finished yet, ask Rosie." And that was maybe 15 years ago. Yeah, we're still here.
Reporting for AK, I'm Ed Ronco in Pelican, Alaska.
Each week on AK, we'll take a tour around the state in a segment called 300 Villages. It's our effort to put every community in Alaska on the radio. This week, we start with a village that only exists for a few months each year, and it springs up in the most unlikely of places, on a glacier at 7,000 feet. We'll let the people there explain.
My name is Lisa Roderick, and I am the Denali Base Camp Manager, and I work for all of the four different air services that are located in Talkeetna. Basically, I'm in charge of the airport here. We call it Kahilna International Airport. But there is a landing strip here on the snow, on the glacier. Yesterday, I had 70 climbers up here all wanting to fly out. Yeah, it gets really busy up here. There's people from all over the world. Everybody's camped out, you know, in their expedition-style tents. As you look out across the glacier, you just see tents and people standing around, and most people are got their cooking stoves going, and they're melting snow to make water, or they're cooking up their dinners. We have one guy from Serbia here right now. Yesterday, the Italians gave me some nice cheese and some nice Parmesan, and, you know, I traded them for some of my lemonade. Showers? No. But, you know, there's other ways to figure that out. You know, you have baby wipes. You can take a baby wipe bath. Sometimes I'll wash my hair. I'll boil some water up and, you know, wash my hair outside.
My name is Chris Erickson. I'm a climbing ranger for Denali National Park, and I am at Cahilda Base Camp, 7,200 feet on the Cahilda Glacier, the jump-off point for most climbers coming to Mount McKinley, Mount Foraker, or Mount Hunter. So as climbers come in, we usually chat with them about route conditions, tell them some things regarding human waste management, where you can and can't do your business. Also about particular problems in the area like crevasses and ravens and trash and all kinds of things. Yeah, base camp is a pretty integral part of the rescue process. We have a small cache of fuel here that the rescue helicopter can use. And so most of the time that there's a rescue going on Mount McKinley, it'll come into base camp either before or after. So we do a lot of coordination, a lot of weather observations for those missions as well. And occasionally, folks go into crevasses around here, or we've had kidney stones, heart problems, all kinds of things on the lower glacier. We end up being a response team for them as well. We didn't get a whole lot of snow over the winter either, and so the conditions this year have been pretty tough. A lot of folks have been going into crevasses. The lower glacier just doesn't have a lot of snow on it anymore. But definitely been kind of a tough year for glacial travel. We went out for a ski one day to check out the conditions, and one of my rope mates went into a crevasse. We were able to pull him out, and then right there at the exact same spot, not the same crevasse, but very close by, another climber went in. And so we helped extricate that person as well. Both of the climbers that went into the crevasses were unharmed, but a little cold, kind of a cold, wet place being down inside a crevasse.
That was National Park Service Ranger Chris Erickson and Denali Base Camp Manager Lisa Roderick. Their village exists from late April to early July. The peak of the climbing season is right about now. And that's it for AK this week. Thanks for listening. To see pictures of Rosie and her bar and Denali Base Camp, visit alaskapublic.org. Tune in next week for a story on kids in Bristol Bay who are studying to be fly fishing guides in Naknek. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.